tight for one superhero-sized Marvel event. First, it's Marvel's Captain America 75 Heroic Years, a look back at the making of an American icon.
I was trying to play it cool. I was nervous.
Then...
You're under arrest.
The two-hour premiere of Marvel's Agent Carter.
Fantastic.
She's headed to Hollywood to crack a chilling new case. And maybe...
I'm gonna punch all of L.A.
A few skulls.
Maybe. I could do with a hobby.
It all starts Tuesday, 8, 7 Central on ABC.
The following podcast contains mature language and spoilers. Listener discretion is advised.
Captain America throws his mighty shield. All those who chose to oppose his shield must yield. If he's led to a fight and a duel is due, then the red and the white and the blue will come through when Captain America throws his mighty shield.
Face front, true believers. Stan Lee presents Diabulu Frank, Illegal Machine, and Mr. Fix-It.
Did either of you ever watch Marvel's Captain America 75 Hero Years?
No. Where would I watch
that? No.
Cap was chosen because of his heart.
For as long as I can remember, I just wanted to do what was right.
He fights for the underdog, people who are being bullied.
He had this charisma that immediately people latched onto.
He was an icon.
I wish to hell I'd have been Captain America.
It's just a guy with a shield. That was something that was really compelling.
What's great about the Marvel heroes is that they're interesting without their superpowers.
Nobody can touch the energy that's in Kirby Pages.
That's the look he was going for.
The biggest impact comic book hero of all time.
He represents the figure that we needed.
He was a great character, ultra patriotic.
The comic book version of a founding father.
There's an action, there's an energy to it.
It was big, it was in your face.
That's what you wanted to see.
But there's more to the story than that.
They say you should never judge a book by its cover, for many times it is not the world's biggest, strongest, and fastest on the outside who have the largest hearts. Such was the case with an undersized kid from Brooklyn named Steve Rogers, who would change the course of comic book history in the Marvel Universe. From his first appearance in 1941 to today's blockbuster films, this is Marvel's Captain America, 75 Heroic Years.
Ran on ABC television. Mostly, you know, it's an hour-long special that they ran ahead of the season 2 launch of Agent Carter. The actual running time was about 42 minutes. And they got, you know, some notable people related to Captain America. They got Chris Evans, Haley Atwell, some S.H.I.E.L.D. cast members like Clark Gregg, screenwriters Marcus and McFeely. And one thing that drove me nuts when they put Captain America out on DVD, the first Avenger I should point out, was that they didn't have any real heavy-duty documentary footage. Like, Iron Man got a really good documentary on his DVD. And then Cap got nothing. And I always speculated that was because there was, I think, ongoing litigation with Joe Simon and possibly Jack Kirby's family over the rights to Captain America. There was another one of those rights versions, hurdles, sometime around then. And I thought that might be the case. And so when ABC did this special, I was hoping that that would fill the gap that I didn't get through the documentary. And it kind of did. They briefly covered the Golden Age history of the character.
Jack Kirby and Joe Simon very much spoke to the American dream.
They were children of Jewish immigrants. They really sort of had to work their way up.
My father grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. They were very poor. They lived in just this little typical tenement all crowded into the one room.
I grew up on some of the rougher neighborhoods.
There were gangs, kids duking out in the streets. It was very rough.
Two young, not terribly large guys. They certainly weren't the kind of image of their hero.
Most times, a fictional character is based purely on the experiences of that particular author.
Jack wasn't a big guy.
He was feisty. He was a fighter. In that time, you had to be.
Joe lived in a neighborhood where there was ethnic strife.
He got bullied a lot.
Kirby had a dislike for bullies in any form.
Regardless of whether the fact he was going to get beat up or not, he would always step in to help.
Joe wanted to go to college, and he couldn't get in. It would only take a certain amount of Jews.
A lot of the writers and artists that worked in comics couldn't get a legitimate job in the Mad Men advertising world.
These incredibly talented people denied fair opportunity, and they created some of the greatest American products.
They met at Fox Publishing. Joe got a job at Timely, which is what Marvel was at the time.
Timely Comics was founded in 1939. Martin Goodman was the publisher.
Joe was the editor, and Jack was the de facto art director.
They were brilliant. I mean, Joe and Jack wrote and drew. They worked as a team.
They were different personalities. My father, the little scrappy guy.
Joe was more the guy who concentrated on the business end of it. Jack was always hunched over the drawing boards, working like a demon, 2-3 pages a day.
The minute Joe Simon saw Jack Kirby's artwork, he knew this was something spectacular.
How kinetic it was, how it moved across the page. He saw it as the work of a master.
They were very good friends, besides being partners.
Jack said, "We're going to move across the street," and Joe said, "Great."
I thought the Kirbys were our cousins.
At that time, the big problem was Adolf Hitler and the Nazis in Germany. I guess that where anybody is from affects the way he writes or draws.
Simon and Kirby, as Jews, they definitely knew what side of the war they were on.
They were very much aware of what was happening to not just Jews, but to everyone.
Martin Goodman wanted some kind of hero comic.
Joe had this idea for a character called the Super American.
They were giving the public something to sort of feed their interest in this situation.
The Times called for a patriotic hero.
This was their way of taking on the Nazi Empire.
Creating this character who would take on Hitler.
They worked on what's the antithesis.
The whole idea of American, what it stood for, thwart evil, fight bullies, defend the downtrodden.
The underdog winning out over the aggressor.
Quintessential ideology of the American dream. There were so many characters with the word super in their title.
It's a captain.
Martin Goodman was afraid that somebody would shoot Hitler before the comic came out.
They had to turn this thing out quick.
Joe and Jack apparently put in a real string of all-nighters.
On the cover of Captain America number one, there is a guy who is wearing the American flag.
Bursting into some Nazi bunker and smashing Hitler with the right cross. That came out, and it was a huge sensation.
That first issue sold 1 million copies. It was so popular.
That cover, while incredibly popular, was also very, very controversial.
We weren't in World War II at that point.
A political statement on the cover of a comic book.
You don't really stop and think about how provocative an image that was. This was a guy who was the head of state of an entire nation, and a nation that was going to war with all the people around him.
Jack and Joe received a lot of hate mail because there were people that felt that Captain America wasn't standing for their ideals.
The American Nazi Party was very strong in New York City. They got a lot of death threats.
There were people actually protesting outside the offices of Timely at that time.
Sinister-looking characters hanging around.
LaGuardia actually placed some protection on the Timely Comics offices.
In a country divided, Cap's place in culture was in question, but something was about to happen that would unite the country completely.
Which will live in infamy.
They talked a lot about the cultural impact of Captain America. They talked to a lot of the Simon and Kirby family members, and I think it was Jack's son actually cried, thinking about how his father would have felt watching the first Captain America movie if he'd been alive to see the first Avenger. That was pretty touching. Now, since this month marks the 80th anniversary of Captain America Comics number 1, and numerous Cap adaptations arrived around this same time of year, I'd like to do a retrospective of his pre-MCU live-action career. So, then we get to the 1944 Captain America Republic movie serial. Have either of you guys ever watched any of that material?
No, sir.
Do you have any strong opinions on the concept of movie serials and your personal experience with them?
I believe I've seen some Flash Gordon ones. I'm sure they were entertaining at the time, but no, I'm not particularly attached to any of them. I mean, I'm somewhat impressed with some of the special effects they were able to pull in off.
These convictions definitely prove that crime doesn't pay. I want to say that the people of this city owe a great deal to you, Mr. District Attorney, Captain America.
Thank you. But we owe a great deal more to Gail. Her cleverness tipped me off to the Scarab's identity.
But Captain America arrived in time to capture the Scarab. It's midnight.
The toll of doom for the Scarab.
It was released around February of that year and re-released in 1953 as Return of Captain America. Because I grew up in the early 80s, that's when Lucasfilm was in dominant. And in particular, they're always talking about how Star Wars and Indiana Jones owe this huge debt to the movie serials. And so they sounded really cool, and they would occasionally run them on like UHF channels. And so I'd always expect to like them, and they always kind of suck. It's one of those things that I like in concept, but in execution never does anything for me. So this particular serial had Dick Purcell as District Attorney Grant Gardner, aka Captain America. You had Lorna Gray as his lovely assistant and frequent damsel in distress, Gail Richards. Now, Mark Miller made Gail Richards Cap's fiance in the Ultimates. You remember that, Fix It?
What was that again?
Cap's fiance in the Ultimate, the one he left behind and grew old without him?
I think so.
Anything special happened with her in there?
Dude, it's been so long since I've read those books. That's the one where they really played Cap as being straight and narrow, right? Like,
not just that, but like a law and order, hard ass right winger.
Yeah, like he couldn't date a woman with a miniskirt or some shit like that.
Okay. Anything else?
No. Dude, it's been so long since I read that stuff.
Gail Richards has no relation to Gail Runciter, Cap's S.H.I.E.L.D. he's love interest, but ultimately stayed true to Bernie Rosenthal in that time period anyway. She was around for like maybe half a dozen issues of the J.M. DeMatteis run. So Dick Purcell, to me, never sells himself in either the role of Captain America or as Grant Gardner. To me, he looked like too much of a heavy. He was also kind of on the heavier side, but he just didn't have the right vibe to him. But this ended up being his biggest film role. He died in a golf club locker room weeks after filming the serial from a heart attack at age 38, and many people believe that it was as a result of the strain of the shooting. Meanwhile, Lorna Gray is a good Lois Lane in all but name. She appeared in pictures until retiring in 1951, with highlights including a Three Stooges short and an early John Wayne flick called Red River Rain. She only just died in 2017, shy of her 100th birthday. The villain in the serial was a guy called the Scarab, who's a mysterious blackmailer responsible for a string of seeming suicides among the wealthy and powerful, using a permanent mind-controlling gas called Purple Death to prompt quote-unquote suicide, also a dynamic vibrator to shake skyscrapers to rubble. D.A. Gardner constantly is compelled to don the Captain America suit and seek justice with his personal car, the occasional motorcycle, and his trusty revolver. Republic had adapted several Fawcett properties, including Captain Marvel and Spy Smasher. It's been theorized that this was supposed to be a Mr. Scarlet script. It was just barely revised to feature Captain America, who was licensed for free to Republic by Martin Goodman to serve as a commercial for comics. This was an especially dumb move because Republic was under no contractual obligation to show fidelity to the comics and didn't even send timely a script until well into production. There's no Nazis in the serial. There's no spies. Captain America is constantly fighting one or two guys at length. There's nothing super about the guy. They never mention the super soldier serum. He fights these guys like for minutes at a time. It gets really tedious, in fact. Despite being the most expensive Republic serial at $222,000 or $3.2 million in adjusted dollars, I don't think there was much to show for it. The collapsing skyscraper model was all right. But for me, the best sequence is maybe halfway through the nearly, what I think it was almost 3 hour running time. Might have been closer to 4 hours. It's a long motherfucker. But the best sequence is about halfway through, and it's where Cap and Hood are fighting in a box. And another Hood goes and turns a laser upon the box, and that creates this big intense fire that Cap bursts through when he collapses one of the walls, and it's just like this white hot heat. That looked really cool, but most of the rest of it is just super repetitive. And it takes way too long to beat the lame villain, who only manages to get away over and over again because he manages to conceal his ID a lot better than Captain America does. Speaking of, everybody knows Grant Gardner's dual identity by the end of the serial, and it just makes no sense, because why would the DA have this extra legal career when he should be authorized to do the shit he's doing anyway? Why bother with the fucking getup? Speaking of the costume, there's no wings on his head, and they ditched the Cavalier boot, so he kind of looks more like a Batman knockoff than anything. Still, Cap was the first Marvel character kind of sort of adapted outside of comics and hit the silver screen over 4 decades before any other Marvel character. The second, of course, was Howard the Duck in 1986, and yet we're still waiting on a team-up.
Grateful nation gives thanks for victory.
Superheroes had served a real purpose during the war, but when the war was over, all of a sudden they looked like they had nothing to do anymore.
We wanted to get back to normalcy.
People perhaps had had enough of war.
A myriad of genres proliferated. There are a lot of crime comics. There are a lot of romance comics.
Aliens come into focus. Sci-fi starts taking over. The enemy was gone. We won. And, you know, Captain America, as you can imagine, took the biggest hit. I mean, he's only there to fight a certain enemy. And they're gone.
The creators involved don't quite know what to do with Captain America. Cap at that time was referred to as Captain America Commie Smasher.
The Cold War isn't exactly the greatest war in terms of action.
Comics were not the preferred way for kids to get entertained.
Everybody had a television. People just started to read less.
And so all the comic books sort of went away, sales tanked.
My publisher, Martin Goodman, told me, let's drop the Captain America books.
Captain America and Human Torch and Submariner were canceled in 1949. We had every reason to believe that there would never again be any real superheroes in comics or anywhere else.
It wasn't until the 1960s, with the birth of Marvel comic books and the rebirth of the modern superhero, that comics really turned around.
Timely's comic book division relaunched in full during 1961 under the name it would be known as from that day forward, Marvel Comics, coined by Goodman himself.
They had a lot of Marvel editorial talking heads like Joe Quesada. They talked a little bit about the 60s revival of Captain America, but they made no mention of DC Comics at all. While they were doing that, it occurred to me that Jay Garrick, the original Golden Age Flash reintroduced in 1961, that the original Green Lantern, Alan Scott, and the Justice Society of America had returned to DC Comics in 63, and then the Acrobat, who was pretending to be Captain America in a 1963 Human Torch story, and the actual Captain America in Avengers number 4 arrived in March of 64. So I think perhaps Captain America's revival might have had something to do with DC Comics, just the same way that the Fantastic Four's existence is attributed to the success of Justice League of America. Aside from cartoons, Captain America wasn't seen until 1973, sort of. The thoroughly unauthorized Turkish film Three Dev Adam, translated as Three Giant Men, also known as Captain America and Santo versus Spider-Man. Fix-It, did you ever watch any of the Santo stuff?
No, I saw a documentary on it too long ago on Disney Plus. It looked interesting.
I remember seeing that as a kid, not so much, like, they used to have the mask at flea markets, and I'd occasionally see the posters, but I've never really sat down and watched one of them. So anyway, this Turkish movie opens with Spider-Man directing his gang to bury a woman up to her neck on a beach. With the threat of a boat propeller to the face fails to yield the information he wants, we see a spray of blood strike the legs of sadistic lady mobster. Then we find out the bloodthirsty spider gang operating out of Turkey is from the Far East, but they're wanted by Captain America for artifact smuggling and by Santo for passing counterfeit bills in Mexico. Spider-Man murders a bunch of people, usually by stabbing or choking, often in the shower like Norman Bates. There's a bunch of teased nudity, including multiple stripping scenes without any actual payoff beyond pace. Spider-Man does get his fuck on in one scene though, complete with nails down the back and a Turkish cover of Jungle Boogie. Mr. Rogers' neighborhood puppets look on and giggle, if that helps you connect this to the Electric Company Spider-Man appearances. It turns out that there are three different guys running around in the Spider-Man outfit. One may in fact be Jack Black from the looks of him. One guy gets his eyeballs eaten out by starved gerbils in plastic tube. The stunt work and fight choreography is somehow the best of any pre-MCU Captain America project, while still definitely being in Swede territory. The Spider-Men get crushed to death, but there's a false alarm in the last scene that leads to a freeze frame laugh. It's not good, but at 81 minutes of mostly action, it's the fastest pace of the movies we're discussing, which leads us into...
Your father developed and perfected the ultimate steroid. He called it FLAG, Full Latent Ability Gain.
He injected himself with the serum, and it worked.
A top secret serum gave Steve Rogers superpowers. Now he can use them to save a city from a madman with a bomb.
Finished.
If he accepts the challenge.
Be Captain America, Steve.
Heather Menzies, Steve Forrest, and Reb Brown as the star-spangled superhero.
Did you ever see the 1979 TV movie?
No. Is that the one where he's driving on a motorcycle?
Mm-hmm.
Pieces of it. I wasn't a big Cap fan at the time, so I did watch all the Incredible Hulk TV movies, but I think maybe I saw half of a Cap at best.
And did you see that first run or on one of the local channels?
Oh, it was a local channel.
Do you remember which one?
Oh, no, man. It would have been like on a weekend.
Yeah, for some reason, I think I remember them running on ABC 13, like the $1 million movie or something. I don't really remember them hitting UHF because obviously Spider-Man was on 26 back in the day. Yeah. I'm sure you caught that plenty.
Yeah.
And I want to say Hulk was on 39, right?
I would say, yeah, 39, yeah.
Yeah. And then I know the Doctor Strange movie, the few times that they ran it was on 39. But I can't really remember.
It sounds right. It's either 39 or 20.
Yeah. And I just can't remember. I'm confident Doctor Strange was 39, but I just can't remember which local stations would run the Cap TV movie. And they didn't run that much. I don't know if there's a rights issue or what, but they didn't run that nearly as much, especially especially as Spider-Man. They ran the shit out of Spider-Man, and they already ever ran Captain America.
I did not know that.
Well, I mean, you never saw it, so it's kind of pudding. If you watch the Hulk ones and you watch the Spidey ones, and I know you weren't a big Cap guy, but probably by default you'd have caught a little bit more than half a Cap if they were showing it with any kind of regularity.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the motorcycle, him putting the shield. I remember him wearing a helmet, things like that. But I don't remember like an entire episode or the entire movie or the plot.
Me wanting to cover the two CBS movies on their 40th anniversary last year, but we never got around to it. As you guys both know, I've brought the DVDs around over and over again over the years without us ever watching it. And I think you guys maybe dodged a bullet. But Mac finally watched it for the first time. What did you think?
Okay, so do you want me to give like a plot synopsis? I took too many notes on this movie, dude.
I've been talking a lot.
I'm so stupid.
No, dude.
Steve Rogers is sort of, I wouldn't say he's like a hippie or he's sort of like a free spirit. So he's been cruising up and down the country or like the Pacific, what do they call it? The road in California that goes down the coast. Pacific Highway, whatever. I don't know, whatever. So he's been cruising in his dope 70s van drawing. Like that's what he just wants to draw, man. I just want to draw. And he's informed in a roundabout way, again, I'm skipping a lot of stuff here, that his father was working on a project on a serum, or as they call it in the movie, a super steroid called Flag.
Full latent ability gain.
Yeah, exactly. And that, you know, he'd synthesized it from his own body, and they'd been giving it to test rats, and the test rats exhibit ridiculous strength and cognitive abilities, and they die. So they're trying to talk Steve into, you know, since you're his son, you know, you should take it too. And he's like, nah, man, I just want to draw. And then he leaves. Meanwhile, he notices that, like, there's been a couple of attempts on his life. Like, when he was driving to see this guy to begin with, to explain this to him, a truck driving up a road dumped a big oil slick, and it's like 5 straight minutes of his van spinning around in circles and him attempting to take control. So he's basically just like shaking the wheel back forth and looking backwards. And then they splice in footage of this van doing like spinning, and then they cut back to him and he's just shaking the wheel back and forth but looking forwards this time. Like it went on forever. It was hilarious. And then anyway, that scene ends with the the van flipping dick first off the edge of a cliff, like just destroying this thing. But because he had his motorcycle on the back, he just hops on his motorcycle and he finishes his journey and never tells this dude, I was just run off the road by an oil slick. He just thought it was just dumb luck, like you know, just another day where I hit an oil slick and it wrecked my van. No need to mention it. So then later on there's another attempt on his life, and you find out what it is they kind of realize this guy's, there's a bad dude, right, who's involved, and he knows this guy is Steve Rogers is the son of the original Captain America, and they say that later on, this guy was actually Captain America with superhuman abilities, and that's what the serum is synthesized out of. So they realize that if his son takes the serum, he could get in their way, and they're basically like, what, like bad oil dudes who were trying to make a bomb, right?
Yeah, I kept thinking of Roxxon, but it's not Roxxon.
Yeah, basically. Anyway, eventually they make another attempt on Steve's life, where they fucking run his motorcycle off the road and just absolutely, I mean, like, it's a below cliff shot of this stuntman and the motorcycle going off the cliff, and then the bike is just rolling down and then bursts into flames, just cataclysmic explosion. And then it's a $10 million man moment where he's on the operating table and they realize the only way to save his life is to give him the Flag injection and make him a huge, you know, souped up steroid guy if he survives. And it's kind of a win-win for them because they're like, oh, look, you know, we can just use this as the reason that we gave him the injection. I mean, I don't know. So then from there, that's for the famous scene where they're like, hey, Steve, we fixed your... Once he kind of agrees, yeah, I'll be your Captain America. They give him this terrible costume. They show where they outfitted his van with all sorts of cool doodads, which is this totally bitchin' motorcycle, which is... I did research. It's a Yamaha TT500 dirt bike. Pretty cool. And it actually was for sale a few years ago on Mecum. So...
There's a removable bulletproof shield that's part of the bike's windscreen.
How do you get it out of here?
Rocket assist for launch out of the van, and jet assist for high-speed acceleration. You're going to need something to protect you on that bike anyway. Why not a disguise? They ridiculed your father, remember? Called him Captain America, and finally murdered him. Be Captain America, Steve.
They show that the bike like fits in the van, and you hit a button and it like a rocket propels the motorcycle out, and there's like a whole montage of him mobbing this thing around in the desert, and it's pretty badass. I think the motorcycle work in this movie is pretty good.
Do you remember back in the comic shop days, there was that one dude who was a Captain America fan and also a motorcyclist?
No.
Okay. I always thought that he was inspired by Captain America, you know, because that was like his two great passions was his motorcycle and Captain America.
Man, I would hope it would be Easy Rider that inspired him and not this movie. But anyway, we know Easy Rider, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Captain America, right? Okay. Reaction there. So, sorry, I'm gonna take a sip of this. Let's see, where else were we at? Sum up. The uniform is god awful. The spandex that he's in, it's so weird. It reminds me of
Do you remember Evel Knievel?
Yeah.
Do you remember, like, they used to have the stunt cycle bike and figure set they would always advertise on the back of 70s comic?
Didn't Toy Story 4 do a take on it with, like,
Keanu Reeves character? That's probably about right. Yeah. I just always remember those ads showing up. And of course, he was supposed to be like this national hero of the time. Simpsons, of course, did a riff on him too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Chicks dig broken bone. But yeah, that's what it reminded me of, because I think he also would have the horizontal American flag stripes and shit on his outfits. Or no, I think they were in a V shape on his outfit. And so I've kind of figured that's what they were going for. But at least Evel Knievel wore sort of a loose fitting uniform, where I got anatomically correct imagery off of this cap costume. Frank and beans, you know?
For sure. We got the full fruit basket, 100%.
You could tell whether or not Cap was cut is what we're saying.
Oh, not that. You mean, you're talking about muscular, right? You're talking
I saw way more of that dude than I was expecting in this damn movie. Especially, I caught it on DVD, and so the clarity was greater than I ever remember in the past. And so the detailing was unnerving.
Good Lord. I'm glad I watched the low-res bootleg version on the internet. So anyway, the movie basically culminates in this oil tycoon. He'd been trying to get the last piece of this puzzle to build this neutron bomb or whatever. So he gets the neutron bomb, and now it's up Captain America and his team to sort of figure out where this guy is. They track the big rig down that's transporting this bomb. They drop Captain America off. He flies out in his motorcycle, jumps on the big rig, takes the big rig smokestack, exhaust stack, bends it into the trailer.
There's an air gap in the trailer portion, and the main bad guy is sitting there with his neutron bomb, and so he essentially smokes him out with carbon monoxide.
Yeah, so then he gets in, and then he fucks up the driver and pulls the thing over, and he gets in there, and he's like, the guy's got a device on his chest. I think it's some sort of, dead man switch, so if the guy dies, the bomb would go off.
Kind of like Spawn.
So, I guess so, I don't know. And
well, anyways, you remember Spawn, right? With Martin Sheen? Spawn with Martin Sheen? He had the same gimmick where if he dies, it sets off a bomb.
It wasn't called Spawn, it was
Spawn. Todd McFarlane's Spawn, the motion picture.
With Charlie Sheen.
Martin Sheen.
That was in the Spawn movie? Mm-hmm. There was some dead man bomb? Mm-hmm. I don't remember any part of that.
Okay, plot. I thought you were talking like The Wraith with Charlie Sheen. Where he's in the car and he keeps blowing up and coming back.
It's Friday, November 21st at a theater near you.
I know that one too. Cheryl and Finn from Twin Peaks is in that one, and topless.
Awesome sides. Car. The car in the Wraith was freaking amazing.
I thought you were talking about The Wraith. I'm like, what? Why would we talk about The Wraith? My bad.
You're exactly right. Why would we talk about The Wraith? Because we were.
Let's talk about The Wraith, guys. I don't want to talk about it. Anyway.
We need a remake.
So, okay. No, we don't. So, anyway, he gets in there. He realizes it's like a dead man trigger or whatever. So, his buddy comes down in the helicopter and just comes in there with some oxygen, and then they're just giving him oxygen to keep him alive so that he doesn't die and set the bomb off. But it's like 5 minutes, it feels like, of them just staring at each other.
And it's that Knight Rider red blip thing trying to get it back into the green so that you know that he's not going to die and set off the neutron bomb. Yeah.
And they're like, he's like, just hold this over his mouth. So Captain America's sitting there holding it on his mouth, and the dude's just pumping the oxygen.
Well, no, that's the funny thing. You got the ambibag, but I don't think anybody actually pumped any oxygen. They just held the ambibag to his face.
But they're just sitting there like looking at each other, and then they would flash the chest thing, and they flash back to Captain America, and they flash back to the guy, and the guy wakes up and they're like, oh, we're done, guys. And it's like, that's the end of the movie.
I think Cap looked okay when he was crawling all over the truck, but it's kind of anticlimactic that two of the bad guys get knocked out because he forces the door of the tractor open and knocks them down a hill. And then the third guy, he'd already gassed out and they're just waiting to make sure he's not going to die. So yeah, very anticlimactic.
I know it wasn't like cut the red wire or cut the blue wire. It was just like, let's give him oxygen and let's just stare at each other until the box turns green. It was like, okay. But there was a lot of that in this movie where they would just cut to somebody who's just staring at the the camera blankly and you're like, okay, well, that was a cut they decided to make, like, oh, whatever. And then they, you know, I guess some dude's wife who they thought was dead was actually alive, and she was being held hostage by this guy, which is how one of Cap buddies had been feeding them plans for this neutron bomb, was to keep her alive. She was being black, you know, whatever. Anyway, that's it. At the very end,
girl that's kidnapped, at least she's not an orphan, because the parent that she thought was dead is alive, and the parent that she also thought was dead is still dead, but she got to keep one, so 50-50 at least.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty good. Although that means she's probably not entitled to any sort of inheritance or insurance policy, so that sucks. But anyway, so then at the very end, Cap's like, you know what, if I'm gonna be Captain America, so there was this great line where they're like, Captain America sure did a great job, and then Cap goes, yep, he really jammed himself down a few throats, didn't he? And then the chick goes, ha-ha! Just like, that was very awkward.
Especially with all that Frankenbeans earlier.
Yeah, he sure jammed himself down a few throats. There was an exchange earlier in the movie where they kept talking about pulling out, and it was just like, oh, I bet he really pulled out. I bet he did pull out. He's going to pull out. And it was just so weird. These conversations are bizarre. Anyway, and then so he says, if I'm going to be Captain America, I need to be the same Captain America my father was. I want to do everything the way he did and look the same way. So then he rides up at the end of the movie and on a motorcycle in the like more traditional Captain America uniform. And then the credits roll.
Yeah, aside from that gigantic helmet that he has to wear as part of the uniform, which I guess is his equivalent of the Wonder Woman diapers. You know, something's got to be ridiculously oversized, comically so, in these adaptations, apparently.
Yeah, that was not good. But, you know, safety, right? I mean, you're going to be safe.
Well, at least it was pretty much the classic costume, so he didn't look quite as ridiculous, although he was still very form-fitting. But that moment was so tacked on that I get the feeling, like, some people have speculated that they were already filming the sequel and that they did that as a tacked on, which I in no way believe. I think what it was, they knew the costume they had was funky looking, and they shot that just in case, and somebody said, yeah, no, we're going to put that in there. We need to switch costumes. This looks terrible. So
yeah, I agree. Because it did. It was like, wow, this doesn't look like a little bit worse than the Captain America uniform. This looks way worse. Like, this looks terrible. So yeah, I'm with you. I bet either they shot that post real quick or they already had it loaded just in case.
Mm-hmm. And you've never seen this movie before?
No, sir.
Okay. So as I've mentioned previously, I used to think that the debut of Star Wars in 1977 was my first movie memory. But thanks to the Cap movie and a lack of 1978 recollections, I now think I saw a revival in 1979. I specifically remember catching part of the TV movie at the home of the same family friends that we saw Star Wars with. I remember half watching it over the shoulder of the boys while we were doing other stuff. I think this was my first instance of thwarted fan entitlement, as I was dismissed with the costume changes made even back then. And it is kind of a quasi-reboot, because they're constantly telling you about all the cool stuff the real Captain America did, and then flashing back to his wet blanket kid. Like, what did you think about University of Southern California fullback Red Brown playing Captain Steve Rogers?
I mean, look, he had like a weird whisper. Like, he would just kind of whisper, hey, well, what do you think about it? And it made him feel kind of dopey. But whatever, he's like a good dude, and he was fit, and he was big. So, I mean, you know, I think he was fine for a TV movie.
I think it was one of those deals where, and, you know, they talk about that a lot when it comes to Chris Evans, is that you need to cast the alter ego and then let superhero part take care of itself. And you look at, you know, you got Bill Bixby to play Bruce Banner for the TV show, and he's the main guy throughout the show. And then you get Lou Ferrigno to be the Hulk, and that works because he's everything you need the Hulk to be. He growls and he looks big, and, you know, it worked. The problem with Captain America is he's always got to be this big brawny dude. And I think that physically, Brown looks fine. You know, even with the funky costumes, he still conveys a Captain America-ness about him. But you can definitely tell that they cast the superhero and not the alter ego, because he seems to really be struggling with the dramatic material.
Yeah, although it did occur to me during this movie that this would be like a pretty good way to bring Captain America back in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, is to just have him and Peggy have had a kid that then gets to, like, maybe is reluctant to inherit the Captain America persona, and they got to convince him to do it or something, since he went back. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Does that make sense? I'd argue that is a way, but this movie tells you why you shouldn't do that, because without the backstory of Steve Rogers, you don't have Captain America. You might as well just move on to the Falcon, because you don't have the character building backstory that you need to create a Steve Rogers.
I mean, because look, Falcon's already going to be Cap. I'm saying that could be part of it too, is that this is the guy who's got to live in some sort of Captain America limelight his whole life, and he's got to find like that. And that's a huge trope too. Come on, that's fine.
I think it's a Frank Sinatra Jr. situation there. I don't think you're going to get the same Cap just because the heredity's there.
I mean, this is the plot to Creed, basically. I mean, it's Apollo Creed's son, who's never taken seriously because he's the son of the famous boxer, and then, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and grew up sort of semi-privileged. Anyway, yeah. I'm just saying, yeah. You could do it. It's a possibility. He went back in time and banged a chick. Come on.
So we've got Lynn Berman as Dr. Simon Mills, and we've got Heather Mitchell Menzies as Dr. Windy Day, note pun. Both did a lot of period TV, appearing in The $6 Million Man and the short-lived Logan's Run TV series. Berman also did a Buck Rogers, while Menzies married Robert Urich, so she got the better end of the deal. Menzies died the same year as Lorna Gray, but she only made it to age 68 on account of brain cancer. There's a bunch of great TV and movie heavies in this movie, including Joseph Ruskin from The Twilight Zone, Mission Impossible, and Get Smart, Lance DeGault, who played Colonel Decker on The A-Team, and Frank Marth from, again, Mission Impossible and $6 Million Man. I think the movie is plainly a Wonder Woman ripoff. You guys have seen the Wonder Woman TV show, right?
Yeah.
Was this pretty much exactly like that, especially the 70s portion?
I would assume so.
Does he work for... He doesn't work for the government, though.
Yeah.
Well, no, didn't she work for the government?
Dude, yeah. They both work for the government, yeah, because she was part of some spy agency where he's working from this amorphous... They're a research firm, but they also have direct line to the president, and they're doing these missions and shit. So, yeah, they're basically doing the same kind of shit.
You mean S.H.I.E.L.D.?
S.H.I.E.L.D., basically, yeah.
Okay, so you're right. Wonder Woman ripped off Captain America's comic.
Because they're both on CBS, I wonder if maybe they were looking to adapt a property that was a lower licensing fee with fewer royalties, since Wonder Woman was in year three at this point. Or maybe they thought they'd get a boost by just having a male actor in the same formula. Definitely not as good as anything Kenneth Johnson did, so I'm sorry for his absence on this show. So, of course, Cap rode a motorcycle in the Golden Age comics and in his movie serial, but appearances of him as a biker had a sharp uptick after the TV movies. As best I can tell, the tricked out van was a TV invention that got picked up late in the 80s. I like that the movie played up him as an artist. That's something we saw in the comics, particularly in the 80s and even into the 90s. And of course, they used that to good effect in the movies, the MCU films. So the Captain America TV movie was ranked 103rd among TV specials in the 1978-1979 season out of a total of 153. It had a rating of 20.7 and a share of 33% of available viewers. It ranked above the Johnny Cash Christmas special, the Bugs Bunny Easter special, and a rerun of Frosty the Snowman that year. When compared to average ratings of TV series, the movie was roughly equivalent to an average episode of Vegas or the CBS Sunday Night Movie at roughly 23 in series rankings for the year. Places it below the likes of Soap, The Dukes of Hazzard, and Fantasy Island. This was well above the ratings of the second and final season of The Amazing Spider-Man TV series, though, which ranked 144th with a 19.1 rating and a 32 share. For further comparison, The Incredible Hulk pilot was an 18.9 and 33%, though that went up to 23.2 and 34% for The Return of the Hulk. Wonder Woman averaged a 59th ranking with a 16.5 rating and a 12.3 million viewers in its final season. The Captain America movie was rebroadcast, broken into two weekly parts in the summer of 1980. The June 14th episode got a 9.1 rating and 18% share, while the June 11th pulled 11.5 rating and 23% share. Randomly, this movie was released theatrically in Columbia in 1981.
And it is here that the struggle for Vietnam may ultimately be decided.
The late 60s were a time of great change for our country, and that meant great change for Captain America.
At that particular time, it was the time of the civil rights movement, street protests, and so forth.
What's great about Stan Lee's writing, he believed in America. He did not close his eyes to what was wrong in the country, but he made Captain America represent the spirit of the possible. He made me believe in the hope of America.
We needed another black character in our books, and I thought Captain America was one guy who was a real loner. And I thought it might be interesting if he had somebody as a partner, a sidekick, or at least a good friend.
Stan had always hated sidekicks. He just didn't like them. That's why he was happy to see Bucky go.
I came up with the idea of the Falcon, somebody who had the ability to fly. You know, if you think about it, Captain America is really the only Marvel superhero who doesn't have a superpower. He can't fly. He's not bulletproof. He's not invisible. He's just a guy who is better than anyone else at what he does. So I thought it would be interesting to give him a partner who had a superpower, who could fly. And I'd make him a black man and call him the Falcon.
The first time I read a Captain America comic was when I raided my brother's comic stash. He had an old Captain America and Falcon comic. I just remember being struck by that image and saying, holy cow, this is amazing. Seeing black faces in a book was pretty rare.
Falcon became this amazing character who connected Cap to the real world in the 60s and 70s.
Here is the modern voice of what youth culture at that time was really going through.
In Harlem, the funeral of a teenager who had been shot by a policeman set off demonstrations against alleged police brutality.
The fact is, the Mad Bomb story is an incredible story that a bunch of rich elites want to overthrow the Constitution, and they want to achieve that by driving Americans mad so they kill each other. We're living that now. That is America today. We're living in the Mad Bomb. It is one of the most prescient comic book stories ever written. I mean, that's the spirit of Marvel, right? You do something shocking and provocative that people really care about.
And then there's Watergate.
Then there was this gigantic scandal with President Nixon.
With Watergate and Vietnam and everything else happening, there was this seed of disillusionment with Steve Rogers and his persona of Captain America.
Watergate just took over America. The whole idea that the president might have done something illegal was a mind-blowing concept in the 70s. Captain America has got to respond to it. I'm the only guy in the world writing Captain America. And if I don't do this, then it doesn't happen, and it just makes sense to me that it should.
This group, the Secret Empire, had infiltrated the very highest levels of American government. He uncovers the whole conspiracy, and the fact that it reaches so high completely disillusions him that he actually gives up being Captain America. And so Steve Rogers comes back in his new costumed identity as Nomad, the man without a country.
But the problem was the name of the book was Captain America, and Nomad wasn't going to sell that book.
And he becomes Captain America once again.
That led to Captain America breaking into the Oval Office and revealing that the person behind the conspiracy was Richard Nixon. You don't see Nixon's face, but there's no question.
Everybody knew that it was Nixon, but there was no way that I was going to, like, actually put Nixon in a Senate hearing, you know. I mean, first of all, not very good comics.
They took the Watergate idea and played it out to its logical conclusion.
That basically gave us the cap versus government scenario, which has been standard ever since.
It's a huge story in the Captain America canon, and there have been sort of variations and things that have been played on it over the years in different circumstances.
Winter Soldier, Civil War, you know, that's the character that we still know today.
SHIELD is not what we thought it was. It's been taken over by Hydra.
I really love the fact that Marvel, over the decades, has really figured out how to make the legacy work and still make sense in 21st century terms.
I thought it was funny because at one point they were lavishing praise on Jack Kirby's artwork and describing one particular two-page spread, except the spread they were showing and talking about was by Jim Steranko, and they never interviewed him once. They got Roy Thomas in there to talk a lot about the 60s stuff, and then when they moved on to the 70s, they really played up the inclusion of Falcon. They talked about how Mad Bomb related to our modern times, and they talked a lot about Secret Empire and the Nomad identity. The main two guys talking there were Steve Englehart, who hated the TV movies, by the way, and then randomly Reginald Hudlund, I guess because they were talking about the Falcon, they want to have at least one black dude on this thing.
In Captain America 2, the U.S. government calls on Steve Rogers to help uncover a sinister plot against the United States by one of the world's deadliest criminals.
Miguel? The revolutionary?
In his quest for world domination, this man plans on holding the United States hostage.
There. In 2 days, we'll have enough of Wilson's aging compound.
He's demanding $1 billion immediately. Or he'll spread a chemical through a major American city, a chemical that will cause rapid aging.
This is a job for Captain America. Reb Brown, Christopher Lee, Connie Selica and Len Berman star in this high-flying action-adventure tale as America's greatest hero battles against overwhelming odds in Captain America 2, Death Too Soon.
So it spawned a sequel, Captain America 2. It was released also in two halves across two different nights, Friday and Saturday, November the 23rd through 24th, 1979. Part 1 had a 16.1 rating and 27% share. Part 2, a 15.6 and 26% share. For comparison, Incredible Hulk Season 1 averaged a 20.4 rating, and the third season was still pulling an 18.7 rating, never dipping below 16.9. The Amazing Spider-Man's ratings and schedule was all over the place, from a high of 21.3 to a low of 12.6 with a 90% share. Again, randomly, Death Too Soon was released theatrically in France in 1980. My understanding is that's where the Death Too Soon subtitle came from, as the TV movie only displays Captain America 2 in the credits. The character of Dr. Winnie Day was recast with Connie Selica, better known for the TV series The Greatest American Hero and Hotel. She was once married to Gil Gerard of Buck Rogers fame, but has been with former Entertainment Tonight host John Tesh since 1992. The biggest differences between the two TV movies was the casting of Christopher Lee as the terrorist Miguel, and much more dynamic directing from Iban Nagy, convicted bookmaker and ex-boyfriend of Hollywood Madam how he flies. In fact, by the end of his career at the turn of the century, he was doing exclusively porn, softcore, and otherwise. The action choreography is also much better, including a gang up on Steve, where he breaks them apart in classic Kirby fashion. Unfortunately, the script is much worse and more episodic, very much a discarded Incredible Hulk episode. Much of the feature has Steve doing a Buford Pusser impression in a corrupt small town. Fix It, did you ever watch Walking Tall?
No. That's the one with Billy Jack or Billy Joe or whatever?
Yeah, with a cane, like not a baseball bat, but like a, I think it's just a stick. He just took a stick and beat up all of that guy.
I believe I watched the Rock version.
Yeah, they did do a remake, didn't they?
Yeah, I saw that, but I've never seen the original.
So there are some definite highlights in this one. In particular, he does more cool stunts with the motorcycle. At one point, he jumps the Jeep of the bad guys running this town. Basically, the town has been taken over by terrorists and the people that they are coercing to work for them because they've been exposed to a gas that prematurely ages them. And unless they get an antidote every few days, they're going to start aging. So they basically make the town do whatever they want to. The plan is for Christopher Lee to blackmail a bunch of major U.S. and international cities, spraying the cities with the gas and then basically holding the antidote against those people. So he's got all these guys in Jeeps running around the town working for him. And at one point, Captain America has to go over a bridge and I think something goes wrong and he ends up falling into the dam. And it was just such a shocking moment to see him and his bike just go into the water. But there's a later sequence where he has to ride into a prison, which is the base of the terrorists. And he's literally like riding around this abandoned prison. It's kind of goofy. And at one point he has to escape the prison. And so he rides off the wall of the prison and then he engages a hang glider that's part of his motorcycle and basically hang glides chasing after Christopher Lee's character there at the end. There's an off-noted moment in the prison too where he's attacked by dog. And it's basically Cap with his transparent shield just sort of fending off dog. The movie ends with Christopher Lee's character getting splashed with aging formula and rapidly aging to his death, which is something that was also threatened at the end of the movie serial. They'd locked up the Lois Lane wannabe into this glass coffin and were pumping gas at her. They're supposed to rapidly age her until Captain America manages to save her in time. So you got these weird motifs that keep continuing with Captain America. And it's especially funny because neither of those two projects had anything involving time. You know, like Captain America is famously the man out of time and he goes from the 40s to at first the 60s and then later on as time progresses. And they've done a bunch of stories where he goes back to the age where he should have been if he hadn't been frozen in ice and shit. So it's weird that idea keeps popping up in stuff, even though neither one of these projects has anything to do with that aspect of the comic.
The costume looks much better in Death Too Soon, too, because he has a Cavalier.
Yes, he does. I mean, it's basically the classic Cap costume, aside from the gigantic-ass helmet.
Yeah.
Okay, so here's the...
So without having seen the second one, what was the better move? First one or the second one?
My argument... The internet seems to agree that the second one is better because of the improved costume, and it's a lot faster paced. But I honestly would say the first one is better because they're telling the origin story, and pardon me, you're a little bit more involved with the characters and the settings, even if you don't like Cap because he's a bit whiny and very apprehensive about doing the job that you're expecting him to do. But the second movie is just such a fucking TV show. And you know, both of these were backdoor pilots. They had hoped they was going to go to series based on the movies. And it definitely shows you a more dynamic Cap in Death Too Soon, but there's just not a lot there. And while I like Christopher Lee, he's barely in it. And you had a lot more heavies taking up a lot more screen time in the first movie that I think actually overall were better than the little bit of time that Lee had. They must have had Lee for like a weekend or so. He's barely in the damn movie. And he's the main selling point besides the direction. I will say though, the action sequences in the second one are better. Cap has more opportunities to do more dynamic fighting. The director of the first movie, I don't think had any business doing action sequences because there aren't any exciting action sequences in the first movie at all. So it kind of depends on where perspective you're coming at it from.
Okay, carry on.
Actually, I'm not sure if I want to because I'm talking so much and I almost feel like I should send you guys off to watch like at least some of the internet content, like the, you know, honest trailers or something.
Nobody ever really thought there was a world beyond comics.
It was a different time. It was very, very tough to produce what we do in the comics properly on screen.
It seemed
awesome.
Awesome in a way that things were awesome back in 1978.
I look back at that old Captain America with a ton of fondness because even though it's incredibly imperfect, as a kid, all you want to see is your characters come to life.
It almost feels like he was just always there. I know I had some friends who read comic books. I wasn't really too into the comic book, but I think the first exposure might have been in the form of a video game.
You know, I didn't see the 1990 version of Captain America.
I'm good. That looks like you're not getting those hours back.
I loved it. As a kid, you don't care. You're just happy to see someone in costume dancing about.
You just think, this is a Captain America movie. This is incredible.
All I could remember was smiling the entire time.
Mr. President! Thanks.
Get your guinea pig.
It happens to be the best damn candidate out of 600 volunteers.
A secret experiment gave one man the strength of 100.
For the rest of the world, he's just codenamed Captain America.
And the power to save millions.
The Jerrys have an experimental rocket ready to fire at a target somewhere in the United States.
Only he could defeat a superhuman madman.
They got a fellow called the Red Skull heading up their outfit.
Saving the world left him trapped in an icy grave until fate released him to finish a battle started decades ago. Ronnie Cox, Kim Gillingham, Scott Paulin as the Red Skull, and Matt Salinger as the Marvel Comics hero, Captain America.
From the, you're talking about the 1990 movie next?
Yeah.
I feel like I've seen this before.
Okay.
Shit. Like, I feel like we watched this like 20 years ago or some shit.
I don't think I had a copy of Cap. My recollection is I saw the 90 movie on VHS one time, and I don't think I ever bought a hard copy of it. But, you know, maybe I bought it a bootleg at one of the times.
It sounds like something we would have watched on a bootleg.
Yeah. But do you guys want to like just watch the honest trailer right quick and then pick up from there?
I suppose Captain America, honest trailer, 1990. Shit, fucker. Okay, I'm watching.
No, 1990 looked pretty good.
I don't know how it is that you are here, or how you remain so unchanged, but it doesn't matter, my brother. Today, you will die. 50 years ago, you were Dr. Vasselli's ridiculous idea. You remain a clownish symbol that no one cares about.
I care.
You care. Then come to me, my brother. Let us see if this heart of yours is stronger than my hate.
Did it bring back any memories?
I vaguely remember watching this.
Yeah, me too, man. I feel like
we watched it together.
Yeah, like I said, maybe I got a bootleg and I forgot about it. But also, what got me is that was in the wilderness years. So it's weird for me that Fix It especially, but really both you guys wouldn't have seen it just because there was such a dearth of superhero content in that time period anyway.
Was that a question? I'm confused by your statement.
No, I'm saying I thought it would be weird if you guys hadn't at least seen it once as because there weren't a lot of other superhero options out there in the 1990 time period.
Yeah, right. No, I think that's what we're saying. Are you agreeing with us? I'm confused.
Yeah, I think we're all in agreement there.
What the fuck is going on in this podcast? Okay, so what's the basic plot? Red Skull's bad guy, and he's mad at the president, kidnaps President Captain America, gets thawed out, comes back to get him.
Fixit, you watched the trailer. You watched the trailer. Never mind. Okay, yeah, that's the basic plot. Yeah, sounds about right.
I was just shocked because Cap hurt.
When did Cap hurt?
Whenever the Red Skull ties him to a rocket, and he tells him, goodbye, Flyboy, and Cap grabs him by the arm, and he goes, there's more than enough room for us, you bastard. And then Skull goes to, I guess, chop his hand instead of stabbing him in the chest, and Cap pulls his hand a little closer toward him, and the Skull ends up cutting off his own hand.
That's a generous assessment. I just thought that the Red Skull was dumb enough to chop off his own hand. I didn't realize that there was any tactical aspect to that that got in the way of that.
I just assumed when I saw him raise the dagger, I thought, oh, he's going to put it through his chest, and then no, he decides to try to cut off Cap's hand, and Cap pulls the old pulsey-roo and he chops his own hand off. That's fucking weird.
Right. Well, cool. And not just that, but he has the artificial hand for the rest of the movie, like he's Luke Skywalker for no particular reason aside from the goofy chopping off his own hand moment.
He definitely had the thick German accent.
Except he's not German, he's Italian.
Is he?
Yep.
Oh, wow. Wait, the Red Skull or...
No, yeah. The Red Skull, yeah.
Wait. Listen to me.
No time, Flyboy.
You can travel cheaply as one, you sick bastard. Now stop the launch.
Stop it or I'm taking you with me.
Disgraziato! Via! Un regli! Es ist zu spät! Zu spät!
side. Falling head!
Not my chance!
No!
They gave him this bullshit Magneto wannabe origin story where he apparently was like a piano prodigy and like a genius boy. And so the fascists go into his home and take him from the home and murder his entire family. And then for some reason, he becomes loyal to the fascists and continues to work with them. Probably like he got brainwashed because in the movie, Erskine is a lady, and I don't think he's called named Erskine. And she was working with the fascists in Italy, and they used her formula against, you know, this boy to turn him into the Red Skull. And in the confusion, she manages to escape and run away. She ends up in the United States, and then she gives a variation on the same formula to Cap. Another weird parallel between the 70s movies and the 90 movie is that they initially gave the serum to rats, and in the 70s movie, the rats would be superhuman super rat for a few days, and then they would die because they couldn't take the formula. In this version, it turned you into this giant mutated red creature, kind of looked like in one of those videos online, they compared it to the rat monkey from Dead Alive, kind of similar to that, but it's like red and bulbous all over and it's stop motion, and so you had like this red skull rat that was running around.
Okay, that's cool.
And so anyway, so in that version, Cap got polio and his family's still alive, and he's even dating not Bernie Rosenthal but Bernie Stewart, I guess because they wanted to anglicize her more or something. And so he's actually got a pretty happy home life, I guess, except for not having a dad, but he still volunteers for the program, and then that's how he loses everybody, because he goes off to fight the red skull kicks his monkey fucking ass. And then they send him on the rocket toward the White House, and he manages to kick the rocket so that it doesn't hit the White House, and instead it flies all the fucking way to the Arctic, because that's how any rocket works. And then that's how he ends up in the ice. But on the way there, he inspires a little boy who's taking pictures of the White House while visiting to eventually grow up to become an activist, and then finally the President of the United States, played by Ronnie Cox of Deliverance, Beverly Hills Cop, RoboCop, and Total Recall fame.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's RoboCop was the first. I was like, oh, that's a dude from RoboCop.
Yeah, my introduction was Beverly Hills Cop, so it took me a while to not see him as the Beverly Hills Cop guy, but Total Recall, I think, was the one where it really sold me on him being a bad guy too. But in this one, he's the good guy. He actually kicks more ass than Captain America in the movie. It's a peculiar thing. So let me give you a little bit of backstory. The Cannon Group, okay, so Marvel was very unhappy with the TV movies, and they pulled Cap from film licensing until they could exercise greater creative control. He continued to appear in animation and in a 1980 PSA for energy conservation. There was a Broadway musical announced later in the decade, including a house ad in the comic seeking young talent for the production, but it never materialized. So the Cannon Group got rights in 1984. They went through multiple scripts spanning years under infamous director Michael Winner. Fix It, did you ever watch that video on Michael Winner where Alex Winter was talking about him?
No.
Him and like his predilection for rape scenes that are filmed over the course of like days.
Oh, yeah, the documentary, yeah, where they do that old Cannon documentary. Yeah, and he was supposed to be a really brutal director. What was the woman that played on Star Trek Next Generation?
Yeah, Marina Sirtis.
Yeah. She seemed to have somewhat of a fond memory of him, but even she kind of was like, yeah, he was a little out of control. Like the shit he pulled, you couldn't do today in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I once watched a video where Winter was talking about how he was basically getting tortured by Winter because he wanted to do his own stunt. And so they made him ride the hood into the underground garage over and over again, just because Winter wanted him to get smacked with the tire iron by Charles Bronson. Charles Bronson over and over again with a tire iron, and it was a real tire iron or was a really well-made dummy. And so he just got his ass beat just because Michael Winner was pissed off at him for some bullshit reason.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There's a lot of fucked up stuff there. Winter, he talks about him in live like viewings of movies and stuff, and really just goes on and on about what a fucking creepo that guy was. So when Michael Winner was finally out of the running, it was announced that the movie would be directed by John Stockwell, who's primarily known as an actor. He didn't really shift gears into directing full-on until the 2000s. He did Crazy Beautiful and Into the Blue. Finally, when the Cannon Group dissolved, Bantam Golem took the rights with him to 21st Century Films, which I don't think survived very long into the 1990s. So the first official Captain America motion picture was never released theatrically in the United States of America. It was barely released anywhere, but officially bowed in the UK on December 14th, 1990, so it just turned 30. Most randomly, it was released in the Philippines under the title Blood Match a year later. Most people caught it on VHS from a Blockbuster video rental beginning on July 22nd, 1992. They couldn't even get it out in time for Independence Day 2 years later.
With the movie Batman setting box office records faster than you can say holy cash register, Hollywood is scrambling to bring more comic book heroes to life on the screen. Flicks stop by the set of Captain America, a film in progress about God, country, and mom's apple pie.
Roll sound, please. We're rolling.
And action.
Ready?
Matt Salinger, who stars as Captain America, is not unfamiliar with the comic book character.
Actually, I read Captain America. It was one of the, he and Submariner were the, were the two that I like. Richie Rich when I was younger, I guess. But do people admit to having read? Yeah. Yeah, I loved them. They were great.
You might think this is the set of just another comic book brought to the silver screen. But Albert Yoon, the director, thinks his movie has something more.
It's got really strong ideas in it. The movie's about something, which is, I think, rare for this type of genre. And I think that even if Captain America wasn't in it, it would still be a story and a character worth seeing on film.
The character is Steve Rogers, an American boy with a bum leg and bad hearing that keeps him out of the regular army during World War II.
He always had a very strong and pure and heroic spirit, but he didn't have the body to be able to do anything with it.
Yeah, going to Gold's Gym.
As part of a military experiment, he undergoes a special procedure that turns him into superhero Captain America.
It was his code name. He was designed to be the first of a whole battalion of super soldiers in World War II. But after the operation proved successful, the scientist was shot, who did it, by a spy.
Captain America has a shield that he throws and a special suit like all comic book heroes. The suit was made by the same costumer as fellow hero Batman, played by Michael Keaton.
I saw some pictures of him at the studio with like towels wrapped all around him, and I was, is that what I'm in for? I asked him.
So, and then she was really good, and her shop was really good, but they just couldn't overcome the real human ears when they come out of that hole. It did a weird sort of wrinkling. We tried to adjust it, and Marvel said, no, you know, it had to be the ears. So we couldn't figure out any other way to make it look sort of seamless. The solution was the fake ears. I think, you know, overall, considering we had to shoot in bright sunlight, and, you know, we didn't have digital sort of CG to help.
Yeah, I'm by very quiet, please. Lock it up.
One thing he's in for is a battle with Nazi creation, the Red Skull. But it wasn't all battles and hardships.
This movie is a great chance for all of us to sort of give voice to that child in us again. That, and we all realize if we had fun making it, that the audience, it's the sort of film that the audience would have fun watching.
I can finally name actors without having to rely exclusively on IMDb. You've got Matt Salinger, who they always like to tell you is the son of J.D. Salinger. He'd also had small roles in Revenge of the Nerds and What Dreams May Come before moving into movie production. You've got Academy Award winner Ned Beatty, probably most famous for Deliverance, but best known to Superman fans as Lex Luthor's bumbling henchman Otis. You've got the Night Stalker Darren McGavin as an evil general, who I instantly watched the same day this year as A Christmas Story. His wife in the movie, Melinda Dillon, plays Steve's mom in this movie. He got a cameo by Lost in Space Bill Mumy. Bill Mumy was best friends with Miguel Ferrer, who was killed by Ronnie Cox in RoboCop. You've got Scott Paulin of The Right Stuff and Teen Wolf playing the Red Skull, though I knew him best as the dad from Pump Up the Volume and Jim Profit's adversary on the cult favorite 1996 Adrian Pazdar TV series.
There's a question about, is it harder to play good guys or bad guys?
Oh, it's all, you know, it's all fun. But this is my favorite bad guy I ever played, and I played a bunch of them. He's just a wonderful character, because as you know, we were just talking about this, he was a character that had all the villainy you wanted, but he had humanity too. And all the way through the film, the way you laced in all of that beautiful stuff about his past and the hurt that he was living through, it's just a really wonderful part to play.
Did you catch that, Fix It, when you were watching the sequence?
No, I didn't.
Do you remember that actor at all?
Michael J. Fox, Team Wolf Dad, right?
No, I think the dad was the heavyset guy, right?
Yeah.
I think he might have been like the principal or something.
Wasn't he like a TV reporter here in Houston?
I don't think so.
I remember.
I know something I don't.
He just looks, I mean, I could be wrong, man. I don't know.
All what was his name? Is the first few times I watched the movie, I did not recognize who that was. And then he has a cameo without the makeup as a different character in the movie. And because that cued me in to kind of pay more attention, that's when I finally caught that that's who he was. He was the dad from Pump Up the Volume. I never realized that the guy playing Red Skull was anybody I would have ever heard of. And he's not like a hugely famous person, but at least he's somebody I would have heard of. And so a lot of the Kinch work in this movie is being done by Red Skull's daughters, or at least a daughter, and then a bunch of like Euro trash Italians that are working for them. It's so weird because you have this sort of like Fenris quality going on, and you've also got sort of like Sin, or Sister Sin from the Mark Gruenwald period. So I don't know if they were pulling that from the comics or what, but it was just interesting that the main villains are like hot Italian chicks and their boy toys, it seems like. The main love interest in the movie is played by Ken Gillingham, who I thought was terrible as Sharon Stewart, who's also the sidekick, and she's in the movie throughout. It was only this week that I learned she was the same actress who played the young and the old versions of Bernice Stewart, who was the love of Cap's life the way Peggy is in the movies. And Gillingham is so much more palatable as Bernice than Sharon, and the fact that I didn't even recognize the actresses were the actress playing a dual role, I think speaks to her skills. So I definitely underestimated her, but it was so bad I couldn't recognize her that I was laughing when Steve confused Sharon for Bernice, even though again it's the same actress, and it was just me not realizing this was all being done by the same person. The movie was directed by the Hawaiian Albert Hyun, who you may remember from the films The Sword of the Sorcerer, Alien from LA, Cyborg, and Brain Smasher: A Love Story. Have y'all seen any of those movies?
That's the Dice Clay one, right?
You got it. And Terry Hatcher. I always thought that was a movie he made like before he got famous, and it turns out no, it was after he'd cooled down. It was in 93, so it was like 3 years after Adventures of Ford Fairlane. Remember for a long time they used to run that on Channel 13 late at night, like pretty consistently?
I think so. That's where I think I saw it.
What about Alien in LA?
No, I'm getting that one mixed up with Earth Girls Are Easy.
That's the one. It's similar. That's the one with Kathy Ireland, and she's got that horrible squeaky voice.
Never saw it.
Yeah, they did a MST3K on that one.
Yeah, the only Kathy Ireland film I ever saw was Necessary Roughness, the football movie.
Now, surely you saw Sword and the Sorcerer, though.
Sword and the Sorcerer. Is that the one with
Lee Horsley with the three blades, and Bull is the demon wizard that he has to fight?
Oh, dude, I saw that forever ago. Yeah, I'm thinking of something else then.
So that's not one of your Conan touchstones of the 80s that you stuck with?
I vaguely... Dude, there was so many of them. I mean, dude, I saw pretty much every Barbarian movie that came out, and they all kind of blend into each other after a while. And it's like, remember this? And I'm like, I think so? What? Didn't they have Twin Barbarians? They're like, no, that was literally Twin Barbarian. Different.
The Barbarian Brothers, yeah.
Yeah, so, yeah, those... That was my Conan phase, and I watched way too many Sword and Sorcerer films. They're all kind of blended in together.
Well, it was immediately no Beastmaster, but it was one with the three-bladed rocket-powered sword.
I kind of remember that part.
And that really hot girl that he was his maiden in that movie?
No. I remember the three swords, because I remember they launch.
Mm-hmm.
And he kills one of the bad guys by launch sword at him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's got Bull. Bull's the villain, you know? Oh, was Bull the villain in that one, or was that the one with Rip Torn?
No, Rip Torn is Beastmaster.
Rip Torn is Beastmaster. Which was the Anthony Zerbe one?
I have no idea, dude.
We're talking about Krull?
They're all barbarians, me.
I don't think it was Krull, no. I'm pretty sure it was... I'm not sure, but they had some good villains in those. Anyway, for the most part, though, Albert Pyun is kind of infamous. Most of his movies are terrible and really low rated and a low budget. But he... Apparently, this was going to be like one of his big break movies, and it didn't really work out. It was reportedly final scriptwriter Stephen Tolkien's choice to not have the Red Skull have a Red Skull for most of the picture, figuring audiences would get sick of looking at his ugly mug. Tolkien is primarily a TV writer, but did uncredited rewrites on Masters of the Universe. Marvel was apparently exerting a lot of creative control. They made sure they had the contract to do that this time. And so as the budget kept shrinking lower and lower from where they thought it was going to be, it ended up being a $3 million picture, reportedly at least. And so Pyun was apparently trying to do things to make up for the budget gap, but Marvel was like, no, you can't do this, no, you can't do that. And so he had a lot of frustration with that. Also, ultimately, the final cut was taken from him, but there is what they call a Red Skull cut that can be found online that adds like 20 some odd minutes. He's talked up a lot about how it was more humanistic and how they focused more on Steve Rogers. I scanned through it because the quality was really bad, and I'd already watched the Blu-ray version. And all the only things I found that were different was when Captain America first parachutes into into Italy, he runs across some resistance fighters who were massacred by opposing forces. Then there was also his Howard Stark, this like general character that he was working under in the 40s.
Here we go. Colonel Ralston Lewis retired in 1957. Since 1971, he's been at the Veterans Administration Hospital here in LA.
And he visits him in a retirement home in the 90s, and the guy has this big long speech.
Sir? I don't believe I've had the pleasure.
Steve Rogers, sir. Captain America.
Oh,
What can I do for you, Captain?
The experiment, Colonel Lewis. Dr. Vizzelli. Project Rebirth.
Rebirth?
I'm back, sir. I can hardly believe it myself, but it's true. Boy, am I glad I found you. Everything's changed so much. But I want to get back into the fight, sir.
The fight? Against what? Pollution? Technology? Progress? Well, it used to be you knew what to fight for. Who to fire at. Now they just keep telling you some dirt poor peasant somewhere that you're going to go blowing the kingdom come. Korea? Vietnam? Who knows what godforsaken place will be next, Hell, boy, look at the names on that wall. Every single one of them is a young fella like you. Died in the mud for no reason at all. War used to mean a fight. To preserve an ideal. To protect a dream. Now it's just a goddamn business. Shit. We don't even know that we're all up a tree just a sawing away the same branch we're sitting on.
Well, have I told you about getting excited, Colonel?
The only time I get excited anymore is when you come around. And I don't remember why.
So I guess that was the heavy-handed political stuff that maybe they wanted to cut out of it. There was also a lot of moping montages, both with Steve Rogers and with whatever the fuck they called the Red Skull once he had the surgery that made him look like he was just a little bit craggy. And then you also have a moment where President Ronnie Kah talking with Sharon while they were locked in prison cells. But it doesn't seem like... It seems like when they... There's a bunch of... about 20 minutes of interviews with Pyun and Salinger where they're talking about that there's this better version of the movie that you didn't get to see. And I kind of don't believe that. Because there was only so much quality you could bring to this movie?
Well, the casting of Captain America was really complex because I had appealed to Marvel if we could have two Steve Rogers, one sort of a skinny and more sickly version of Steve Rogers in the beginning, and then I wanted to cast Howie Long, football player, as the Captain America when he was after the experiment. And Marvel said no, it had to be the same guy. And then I thought, well, maybe if we could change the color of the costume, because they had a black costume, Captain America, at that time, but they didn't let us do that either. So the casting was really governed by the fact that we had very little flexibility in what we could do, and so we needed to find somebody that could fit both sides of the role.
I think the people that really deserve a lot of credit in this movie are really the actors. I think Matt really did a terrific job of dealing with all the fact that he could see that the film was falling apart, and he still had the courage and conviction to really sell that character. He never ever, you know, waffled or felt that he was silly or anything. He really had a strong conviction about the character, and I think that's really what makes this work, is that everybody in it is in it for passion, and they just didn't let the circumstances surrounding the production affect their belief in it and their work. One of the reasons I cast Matt was that I thought that the quality he brought to it really organically was the fact that I'm sure he, growing up, had to live up to a certain ideal of what people had of who he should be and how he should be, and I thought that kind of brought that honestly to the role, where all these people had expectations of Steve Rogers and what Steve Rogers was supposed to be. And I thought that Matt really could understand what it was like to have that burden of huge expectations, you know, of being J.D. Salinger. found your son, and so you must be really gifted and all this stuff. And naturally, everybody, the first thing they do when they meet Matt, they ask about his father, a difficult thing. And I thought, you know, he did really well by bringing that into the role. And it was a little difficult, actually, in the beginning when we talked about it, because I wasn't sure how he would take that. He embraced it. I hope someday I'm able to screen this version for him, because I know he was horrified by the release version. You know, and I feel really bad for him, you know, because he's had to live with sort of this infamy for the last 22 years. You know, we all have, but him in particular, because he's the face of the movie.
What I wish I could have tracked down, though, is apparently Marvel did a movie adaptation of it that was by Stan Lee, Bob Hall, and Tom Morgan. They came out a few months before the VHS, but I know I flipped through that in years past, but I never thought to look for like cut scenes and stuff. Rotten Tomatoes rates this movie at 7%. And rewatching it today, it wasn't as bad as I remembered, but you know, Dick Tracy had already come out, Darkman, Batman Returns. So even in the wilderness of no superhero movies, I thought there were a lot better options. And of course, this being Captain America, I'm going to take any fuck ups to heart with this. And Rubber Ears on down, there were a lot of fuck ups in that particular movie.
Version out there, dude. The Snyder cut is out there.
But what do you, you know, by your recollections of the movie and by what you've seen with the costume and the action and everything else, what did you think about it?
Look, man. Okay, you said, what was the budget for it?
$3 million.
$3 million. Okay, just to put it, okay, and I think it's important that any comic book movie in this era, it will always be compared to Batman 89, right? Batman 89's budget was $35 million, bro.
And that was a really big budget of the day, too, though.
Exactly. Versus $3 million. I mean, let's give him a break here. Yeah, sure, the movie sucked. And I do think that on it, like, maybe this is my opinion, maybe you guys can disagree. I think Red Skull looked pretty good.
Yeah, I really like the Red Skull makeup, actually. I like the grayed eyes I gave him. He looked really creepy. Yeah, yeah.
I think that was a huge mistake to change that. I think that would have made it, like, much better. And then, I mean, look, costume, they should have found a way to get the mask ripped off early on and have him run around in the costume with no mask. You know, like they do basically in all the current Avenger movies. He's hardly ever actually wearing the mask anymore. I think they should have done something like that, and it probably would have been better. Obviously, the acting was terrible. The plot's ridiculous. Look, it sucks. It sucked. It's bad. But, you know, at least as far as the looks go, I think with a $3 million budget, and they did okay.
Yeah, it definitely a shaggy dog. But again, I hated this movie the first time I saw it. And watching it again today, I can't manifest that much animosity toward it, because I know they didn't have a lot to work with. Because they've got some pretty good actors, likable actors in here for decent segments of the movie. I could have used some more Ned Beatty, for instance, but Ronnie Cox is pretty cool in this. You got the action scenes at the end where Ronnie Cox is actually doing more punching and kicking than Cap was doing. So he's the most kick-ass president since Air Force One, at least. I thought they did a nice job because they couldn't do all the cool VFX. I actually thought that Salinger did a good job of, they put him in baggy clothing and he had to pretend like he had polio. And because he had sort of this hangdog look for most of the movie anyway, I actually had a decent time seeing him as Steve Rogers. I think he's definitely cast as Steve Rogers, and he works better in that role. When they try to put him in the suit, that's when things start to kind of go awry. But the action choreography is better than I remember. The editing is fucking headache inducing, though. There's like a one action sequence that has like 30 some odd cuts to it. And that's like, it's almost nauseating because there's just so much going on that's barely comprehensible. But it could have been a lot worse. It sort of like got that sort of Corman Fantastic Four element to it. I don't think it's as good as that movie, which is certainly damning with faint praise to begin with, but it's just not nearly as bad as I remembered it being. And so the only thing I will say, though, I think that it's a lot easier for me to take all these movies now that we've had actual good Captain America movies, because it's not like trying to figure out how to sell Captain America to an audience and trying to convey to the people why you love the character. These movies, I don't think, can pull that off. And now that the real movies have come out since then, and Captain America is one of the most popular heroes in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, there isn't as much resting on the shoulders of these movies, so I can forgive them a lot of their fault in retrospect.
Yeah, I guess that's a good point. That's probably why I'm looking at these as kind of, that was nice, but because we know we have there's payoff in the end, right? Whereas probably back then we didn't have the payoff, so yeah.
As a result, I think Captain America faded back a bit. I don't think Cap ever faded back entirely, because there were too many comic book writers and artists who adored the character.
And then, of all people, Todd McFarlane was on the fucking thing. Just totally like, what are you doing here, dude? Mostly he was talking about the comics in the 90s, less about Captain America himself. So they pretty much jumped from the 70s to the 2000s. Aside from using lots of Ron Garney images, they really seemed to like Ron Garney. And it was curious because there was like a total absence of like John Romita and Mike Zeck and Joe Kubert. I mean, not Joe Kubert. Whichever Kubert boy, I think it was Adam Kubert who was doing it. But they did spend a lot of time with John Cassidy. And you did you guys ever read the John A. Reber run on Cap?
I think I've got it. I don't know if I read it.
What's any particular arcs in that run?
Well, I was just that it was drawn by John Cassidy. And that was the like post 9/11. Do I need to go punch Osama bin Laden run?
I think I have those issues. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually have those issues.
Didn't Jay Lee do an arc?
Jay Lee? That I'm not sure.
Well, anyway,
that's the one where Cap looks like he has armor, right?
Yeah, that's when they really started doing like every single shingle.
Chainmail armor.
Chainmail, yeah. So yeah, they talked to Cassidy a lot and they showed a lot of images from that time period. And it was a little weird. I was getting some like Frank Miller Horror Terror vibes coming off of some of the stuff they were showing. They, of course, talked to Mark Miller, who mostly talked a little bit about Ultimates, I think, but mostly focused on Civil War and what Captain America meant and the schism between Cap and Iron Man. They played up the death of Captain America and the return of Bucky as the Winter Soldier. That's the only time they really seemed to touch on the Ed Brubaker material. And then they devoted like the last 5 to 10 minutes to just talking up the Civil War movie that was about to come out. And like I said, it was an okay documentary, but it was like really hyperactive. The clips would come so quickly that they'd have like the name of the person speaking and what their relevance was. And it was going by so fast, you didn't have a chance to even read their name placard before they were moving on to the next person. So I went to IMDb and I wasn't the only one who felt like they could have maybe had at least 50 to 100% more time on this thing to cover this material so it wouldn't be so freaking hyper. It only aired one time on ABC television on Tuesday, January the 19th, 2016. It got 1.42 million viewers. It was ranked last in the 18-49 demographic in total viewers. It was crushed by 48 Hours' 5.18 million, Two Flavors NCIS at 4.57 million, as well as the Stanley Cup playoffs at 2.47 million. Even 2020 in a boxing match on Fox did better. But if you're ever interested, you can buy it on Amazon Prime for $2.99.
There was always a Captain America somewhere. Maybe he wasn't wearing kind of leathered spandex, but there was always a Captain America.
Suiting up to try and give yourself for something bigger than you, because you believe in something. You believe in something good and right and just. It's powerful.
Captain America can go on as long as there is heroic entertainment.
It's about what he represents as a symbol of an idea.
And that's who he'll be 75 years from now.
He's open, he's honest. So the more unanswerable questions you present to him, the more dynamic the character becomes.
The Marvel Universe is best when it takes big swings and moves the ball down the field.
You're telling stories, visual stories, with writing and art, and you've got to have both. You've got to have people on both sides of that equation doing their best work if you want the best final product.
The interest in that kind of storytelling, those kinds of characters, is not going to go away.
These characters have to be relatable. They have to have a heart to them. That means that the stories have so much more weight.
Cap is so morally sound that when you throw a conflict his way, how he reacts is so telling and colorful because he's such a consistent character.
But Cap is rock solid. He's always pointing north.
He represents what America should be.
The spirit of the possible, of the American dream.
What better hero to live vicariously through than Captain America?
And I think as long as we can keep him as that kind of a beacon, he's going to be a character that people always want to watch.
People can relate to it and at the same time can dream about what they could become.
If you believe in something and you go about it in a way that will help others, then you truly are a hero.
Permanent Marvelite Maximus followers include Adam the Martian, the Architect of Mars, Ale, Angel Moreno, Ahmad Sin, Bad Tweets R Us, Bruce Ginn and Big Rain, Comics and Movies and All That Jazz, David Grover, Edward Huey, Homework the Podcast, Jason Roga, Carl Disley, Monthly Monday Movie Muckabout, Prairie Justice, a Greg Sanders Vigilante Podcast by our friend Gord Tolton, Raj Kumar, Retro Atomic Radio, Spider 6X, Stimbot 5000, Stronium Pod, and Trumped by Music. Our sole retweet frantic one was Talk Nerdy to Me. Keepers of the Favorites Flame include Alan Middleton, Big Movie Blog, Casey Lau, who added a D-Lin, you son of a bitch, Predator GIF, Comic Query, Constantine Kotsiris, Construct Comic Pod, Demi, Doc Strange, The Earth 2 Podcast, Elisa McCausland, GK Wordsmith, I'm Not Chris Hemsworth, Ian Vollmer, Jason Roga, Jennifer DeRoss, Jim Imbruglia, Yogos Clásicos y Antiguos, John is Watching Cartoons, King Dinosaur, Con L, Law Dog, RPG Historian, Legit Physics, Malhidos, Roberval, Marvel Universe Online, Max Reads Comics, who added Following, Maz at Mazinger 1978, Michael Wagner, Mike at Send Aliens to Me, Mix Jeffrey Brown, Nick Smith, Noise Serve, Pesadinto, Ally of Krakoa, Richard Field, Ricky Bell Jr., Ryan Burke, Ryan Daly, Schlocktopus, Secret Wars and Beyond Podcast, Steve Cantor, Steve Ellis, Trans Lesbian Planet Eater, Wacky Bronze Silver Comic Book Villains, Warlord Worlds, Weapon Extra, and Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace Podcast. Among our nephsayers was Canoes, who tweeted, going to have a listen now, and Odell Abner Dracula, who said, another good episode, but I'd be completely fine if you never mentioned the snap or the gap ever again. Forward, not backwards. P.S. Devil Hulk debuted in the Jenkins run. P.P.S. Immortal Hulk is awesome.
The Merry Marching Society of the Marvel Superhero Podcast.
1/8 Sage, Baby Skeletor, who wrote, being part of the RSP Army makes me want to shout thanks, and included a Darkman Carney gift. Bennett Excelsior 73, Brian Dockery, Canoes, Chris Dunford, who added, always great to be noticed by the cool kids, many thanks RSP, Chris Lydon, Dirk Ashton, who wrote, thank you RSP, Firestorm Fan, Green Lantern HG, I've Been Good Santa, The Hammer Strikes, Geeky Stuff, and Hashtag Voiceover, Harmless Entertainment, History of Comics on Film, Hulkling, Hashtag Black Lives Matter, Iowa's Joe Crawford, Jason Snicked Venable, Jenna Reagan, who added Yes Yes with heart emojis, Carl Ottersberg, who offered belated thanks and have a safe, healthy, and happy holiday season, Keith G. Baker, King Size Comics, Giant Size Fun Podcast, Nathaniel Devon Sanford, Paranormal News Network, Paul Matthew Carr, Randy Caldwell, Resurrections and Adam Marvel and Thanos Podcast, Reverend Odell Abner Dracula, Richard G., who noted, love that title, great group to champion. Here with two. Thanks. Tim Price, Pod Crasher, Tony Scipione, Tora, and Zwit Jameson.
All characters and concepts appearing in the official handbook of the Marvel Universe and the distinct likenesses thereof are the trademark and copyright of Marvel Entertainment LLC, a subsidiary of the Walt Disney Company. This has been a non-for-profit fan production from Rolled Spine Podcast. Any copyrighted material presented herein are presumed covered under fair use, with no infringement intended. Till next time, Excelsior!
Right along to the Viking song of the Merry Marvel Marching Society! Stand a little straighter, walk a little prouder, be an innovator, laugh a little louder, go forever greater, we can show you how to.
Shouldn't even be a contest. I mean, Iron Man was the first movie, the first character to come out in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
You know, Cap was the first character to ever be on screen for Marvel.
That is a flat-out lie.
Ever.
We could just ask the next schmuck who walks through, hey, sir, hi. Hey, we're going to put this all on you. Is it Team Iron Man or Team Cap?
I really don't care. As long as I get a good cameo, call my agent.
Savvy.
Captain America.
Captain America. No doubt about that, huh?
No doubt about that.
And why is that?
Well, because Chris is about a half inch taller than Robert Downey Jr. You need a reason. That's as good a reason. No, I don't care. I love them both, and they're both going to look real good on screen, and the audience is going to have a tough time taking sides. They're going to love them both.